Hi, welcome to the Science Progress Podcast. I'm Diana Epstein, and I'm here today with Dr. Eric Plutzer to discuss his new book, Evolution, Creationism, and the Battle to Control America's Classrooms. Welcome, and thanks for joining us today.
Yes, I'm delighted to be here, Diana.
So let's start, if you would, can you tell me a little bit about your background, and why did you get involved in this project in the first place?
Okay, well, Michael Berkman and I are both political scientists. One of the things that we're very much interested in is how public policy takes into account the preferences of ordinary Americans. And on many issues, the balance tips heavily in terms of moneyed interest groups rather than public opinion. But on evolution, it's a lot more complicated. It's a lot more complicated because the general public is not that well informed. The general public is at best ambivalent about the teaching of creationism, and many Americans, out of a sense of fair play, when asked, say, well, sure, go ahead, teach both sides. And so this represents for us an interesting dilemma for little d Democrats in terms of what's the appropriate balance of power in terms of who should decide what is taught in the public schools. And so this builds on our earlier work looking at how school districts are responsive to public preferences in terms of public finance. Although, interestingly, in the last few months, what we've seen is an erosion of power for individual communities to decide on their spending levels, as reforms in places like New Jersey and those proposed in Wisconsin are also limiting local citizens' ability to fund schools at the levels that they find appropriate. And so a convergence that we didn't expect between the study of school finance and the study of evolution.
So who should control the nation's public schools and determine what students should learn?
Well, the question is a simple one, but it's actually quite complicated. I think America has a long tradition of local control of schooling, going back to the one-room schoolhouse more than a century ago. But since that time, that ideal has become more mythical and more impractical. And many different parties seek to control what our students learn and have varying degrees of influence. And this includes our state governments that establish curricular content goals, sometimes with the high-stakes testing aligned with those curricular goals. It includes experts from the various subject matters, historians, mathematicians, and scientists. It includes pedagogical experts, many of whom are housed in our nation's schools of education, and many of whom work in state departments of education. And there are, of course, parents who have a special interest in what their children are taught. And finally, there are the teachers who are professionals and enjoy a certain amount of autonomy to make judgments in terms of what they think is best for the students. And so in this mix, there are often controversies about what should be taught, how it should be taught, what should be emphasized, and what the goals of a K-12 public education ought to be.
Great. So digging a little deeper into the main topic of your book, why is understanding evolution so important in terms of future scientific inquiry?
Well, we think that the treatment of evolution is first of all, central to modern biology. And with respect to biology in particular, if teachers sidestep evolution and avoid controversy, they're cheating their students out of a sound science education. More broadly than that, evolution is an outstanding opportunity for teachers to convey the nature of science to students. It is an ideal example to show the limits of science, the types of questions that science can and cannot answer. But perhaps more important, evolution, more than chemistry, for example, conveys the way that science moves forward through a series of experiments that are peer-reviewed, appear in scientific journals, that are debated and accumulate, and only with convergent evidence produced by many different scientists using many different techniques do we come to accept certain findings as essentially factual. And evolution offers a terrific example to do that. And third, in avoiding controversy, many teachers inadvertently convey to their students the notion that the that evolution is simply a matter of opinion, and that students armed with 8 or 10 or 15 hours of classroom instruction combined with their prior knowledge from museums, television, sermons, and Sunday school can make an informed judgment about the validity of conclusions regarding evolutionary biology, that it's simply something that can be debated. And this undermines a confidence in expertise, which I think is a dangerous thing for a modern democracy.
So just following up on that point, how does teaching creationism as a valid alternate theory undermine this legitimacy of science?
Well, creationism is essentially taught as an alternative approach to the origins of life on Earth and human life in particular, but it is not based on any bench science, and it is not based on accumulation of findings made by experts that survive the very rigorous peer review process. And it is typically not based on rigorous scientific hypotheses that can be falsified. And so there are many creation stories, often that fill in gaps that science cannot address. Modern science cannot address the origins of life on the planet Earth, although there's a lot of speculation. And creation stories from various religions provide alternative narratives for that. But what creation stories cannot be is modern science as we understand it today. And there's nothing wrong with teaching creationism in social studies classes or classes on comparative religion or philosophy, but it's inappropriate in our view and in the view of most major scientific organizations to teach creationism as science in a science class.
Okay, so as part of your research for this book, you and your co-author conducted a national survey of high school biology teachers. Tell us what you found in that survey.
Well, we surveyed primarily with pencil and paper surveys, although for those that preferred to complete the survey on the web, they were able to do it on the internet. We surveyed over 900 teachers from every part of the country in every type of public school. And they reported to us on how they cover topics related to evolution, as well as some other topics in their general biology classes. This is a class that most students would typically take during ninth or tenth grade. And what we found was that about 13% of teachers explicitly endorse creationism as a valid scientific alternative. This particular finding was perhaps not that surprising in light of some earlier studies, some in Minnesota, some in Ohio, some in Massachusetts, that pointed in the same direction. What did surprise us is that these teachers can be found in every state in the union. They're not confined, as some people might expect, to the states associated with the Bible Belt, but they can be found in New England, West Coast, and in the Midwest, as well as the South. This is troubling because these teachers are stepping across the bright red line established by the Supreme Court, which has ruled that the teaching of creationism is really the unconstitutional advancement of a particular perspective deriving from religion. But perhaps more disturbing for us was the fact that we estimate that about 60% of the nation's teachers are covering evolution, but are doing it in a way that is not very rigorous, in a way that suggests that the teachers are cautious, sensitive to avoiding controversy in their communities. This leads them to a variety of techniques of avoidance, which have the effect of cheating students out of really a sound science education.
And how does the community context play a role in whether and how evolution is taught in classrooms?
Well, communities are very important, and communities have an impact in several ways. First of all, for communities that are relatively homogeneous in their cultural character, those communities tend to hire teachers that are going to fit in with the community. And so for those communities in small towns that have a large number of conservative Protestants, the folks associated with churches that are sometimes called fundamentalist or evangelical, those school districts will tend to hire teachers that are either sympathetic to creationism or intelligent design from the get-go, or teachers who have not had the highest levels of training on the science side of their education. They may have had a lot of courses in pedagogy, but they're likely to have had fewer in biological science, and they're especially unlikely to have completed a course in evolution. So in this way, communities select in teachers who are not likely to make waves. The second way that communities matter is that teachers are sensitive to local concerns. They do not want to offend their students or their parents, and they're especially cautious. Teachers want to avoid exactly what every student wants to avoid, and that is a call to the principal's office. And as a result, teachers are really good at intuiting the types of curricular assignments, class demonstrations that might generate some controversy from the community. Now, there are many teachers who understand this, but they're very well trained and they're very confident that if a parent or a member of the community complained, they could simply sit down and say that, you know, this is part of the curriculum, it's in the textbook, this is a core concept in modern biology, and while I respect your concerns, I'm here to teach science, and feel confident that if those parents or community members then challenge them on so-called weaknesses in the theory of evolution, that they could respond point by point and sort of hold their ground. But there are many teachers who report to us that they don't feel that confident, that they don't feel their training in evolutionary biology was particularly strong. And these are the teachers that seem to go out of their way to minimize discussions of evolution, and especially minimize those that might be viewed as most controversial, in particular the discussion of human evolution.
Okay, great. So to bring this all back to the policy realm, what are your recommendations to strengthen the teaching of evolution in public schools?
Well, we think that there are several things that the scientific community can be focusing on. One is to continue paying attention to state curricular and textbook decisions. And the major scientific organizations have done a terrific job with that. And in the last 4 or 5 years, many states that had relatively weak standards with respect to evolution, states such as Florida, have actually made them more rigorous under pressure and guidance from the scientific community. So we think that's very important. Second, when the standards are effective, and the standards are very specific, those standards have more bite when they are aligned with statewide or some other kind of high stakes examination. This eliminates some of the discretion that teachers exercise in their own classrooms. But we think there are substantial limits to what can be done simply at the state level. And we think that long term, the greatest potential is in a more rigorous training of our future science teachers. Those young people who want to be biology teachers in the future go to a wide range of colleges and universities. Some go to the major flagship research universities in their state, and they have access to National Science Foundation funded laboratories, faculty doing cutting edge work. But many more go to smaller four-year colleges, and the scientific culture there may not be quite the same. Most of those four-year colleges cannot offer a wide variety of classes. But regardless of the institution, we think it would be extremely helpful if evolutionary biology became a required element in the biology major, so that all teachers who get certified as highly qualified and can take their place in classrooms will have completed a semester-long course in evolutionary biology. Our research suggests that for many teachers in the middle who would really like to do a better job, would really like to cover more topics, but are not confident that they will come out of some kind of controversy unscathed, having a greater background in the basic science would make a substantial difference. And so we think this should be a very high priority in the near future.
Okay, great. Thanks. So just to wrap up here, is there anything else that you'd like to add that we didn't get a chance to talk about?
Let's see. In the op-ed, we talked about possible linkage between opposition to evolution and opposition to claims about human sources of climate change. And a year ago, I exchanged some emails with Naomi Oreskes, the author of a book entitled Merchants of Doubt, which looks at efforts to dissuade the public from thinking that climate change is a serious problem and one that is caused by human activity. And she suggested that there were a lot of similarities between the evolution case and the climate change case. And I wrote back, I said, actually, I don't see it that way. What's happened is that through a convergence of convenience and pragmatism, we now see increasingly politicians linking these two issues. And so the stakes in the evolution wars have actually gotten considerably larger. For many who oppose evolution, the bringing in of another issue, one that does not have a religious root at the core of the controversy, allows them to say, well, we're being consistent across all issues. It's not a matter of religion. And this may provide a window to introduce proposals that do not appear on their face to have religious motivations. And on the other side of the coin, those who are doubters of human causes of climate change can tap into an enormously effective grassroots network of religious conservatives who are already mobilized around issues such as the teaching of evolution in schools. And so what you're seeing is a coalition of convenience across two issues that were not necessarily linked in the public's mind several years ago. But I think you'll see that it's increasingly the case. And this is part of a larger trend in terms of putting science and scientific institutions on the defensive in a political context, where most scientists would prefer to be relatively independent and do their work as insulated as possible from political pressures. And so we see this as central to emerging politics that Christopher Mooney has documented in his books in terms of the Republican War on Science and so on. So we think this is extremely important, and it's an ominous trend and certainly something we should be looking at more carefully.
That is a very interesting connection. Just wanted to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. And again, the book is Evolution, Creationism, and the Battle to Control America's Classrooms.
It's been my pleasure, Diana.